Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the Supreme Court upheld President Obama's Health Care Reform Act. What does that mean for California and Fresno County? Plus, 40 years after Title IX, the gender equity law, how has it impacted girls and women? And Big Brothers, Big Sisters, why they need more of us to sign up. But first, health care reform. About one-third of residents in Fresno County are uninsured, another 31% covered by Medi-Cal. Statewide, California has the nation's largest number of uninsured people, about 7 million. Some also say that California is more prepared than other states to move ahead with health care reform. Joining us this morning for the discussion are Dr. John Kapitman, Executive Director, San Joaquin Valley Health Policy Institute, and Kevin Hamilton, Deputy Chief of Programs, Clinica Sierra Vista. Before we break it down and talk about the Health Care Reform Act, I would like for both of you to briefly state what you think this will mean for California and the Valley. We'll start with you, Dr. Kapitman.
Sure. So in affirming the 2010 Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court paved the way for California to move forward with some of the important elements of the Affordable Care Act, including the expansion of Medicaid to folks up to 133% of poverty, like $30,000 for a family of four, to establish the healthcare exchange, a marketplace that those who work with small businesses or are otherwise uninsured can go to that and select appropriate insurance and receive in many cases subsidies. For the San Joaquin Valley, nearly a million people will be eligible for some kind of newly subsidized insurance. Nearly 300,000 will be newly on Medi-Cal. So there are important new opportunities for people to get health care. And then important challenges for the health care system, real pressure on us to become more efficient and more effective, to focus on how we give care in the best ways we can. So both exciting opportunities and some important challenges.
Okay.
And from the community health center perspective, we see the opportunity to grow and expand to provide services for this newly insured group of folks. We're very excited about this. We're hoping to see patients now insured who are faced with the everyday challenges of trying to take care of themselves with chronic illness and no insurance. While the health centers often have programs to help these folks through that particular barrier, in the end, they're always going to have to come out of pocket with money that they don't have and are often not able to carry through with long-term care plans for diseases like hypertension and diabetes that we know lead to things like amputations and strokes that cost the health system so much. So here's a real opportunity to turn that clock back, if you will, and ultimately save an incredible amount of money. Another thing that's going to happen here in the Valley is we're going to see employment in the healthcare industry increase. There's been a lot of rhetoric in the bill about how it somehow is a job killer. I've never quite been able to understand that, and there's no one in any reputable organization who's been able to sustain that or prove that contention. In fact, just the opposite, as again, we have more people to serve. As in any business, we will need more people to serve them. We expect to have to increase the size of the healthcare services area about 20%. Which translates into literally thousands of new jobs here in the Valley.
Well, you know, in preparing for this particular segment, I came across a research after research, paper after paper, that indeed talked about the fact the number of jobs that are going to be created, and also mention some of the fields where they're really going to need people. Dr. Kappelman, you said part of this, we talk about the great benefits, but also the challenges for us to really reform our healthcare system, which is something everyone agrees needed to be done and needs to be done. So when it comes to those kind of challenges, what specifically are we talking about? What are we going to need to do? I mean, because we've been limping along with a healthcare system that everybody agrees needs some major overhaul.
For me, the criteria for judging a healthcare system are about how well we're covering the whole population. Are we achieving universal coverage? Are we doing something that's sustainable, that's affordable for individuals and affordable for the country? And are we giving the best care that we can? Are we actually making the country healthier? And there really are important concerns about the Affordable Care Act from both the right and the left that we need to address moving forward. I think one of the biggest concerns for us in the Valley is that undocumented people are excluded from the expansions involved in the Affordable Care Act. And that represents an important population in the Valley. Nearly a third of Valley children live in a home where at least one other person is undocumented. Healthcare choices are family choices. And so having a large group of our population excluded is going to make it more difficult to achieve universal coverage even for those who are covered. So that challenge around universality is really big here. The other big challenge for us is around effectiveness. We have had a healthcare system in the Valley that often has people wait until they're very sick to seek care because it's been difficult and costly and hard to get care. And so even with the wonderful system of primary care that we have in the Valley, that system is going to have to ramp up. I think that this is what Kevin's speaking to, ramp up its capacity to engage people in preventive care, engage people in a new relationship with the health system.
You know, one of the things in talking about implementing health care reform, and one of the reasons they talked about California, is that when the Health Care Reform Act was signed into law in 2010, California moved ahead. You had a lot of people waiting to see if the Supreme Court was going to upheld it, if it was going to be overturned. They were concerned about all the politics surrounding this. California decided to move ahead. So hasn't that sort of positioned California in a way to kind of take advantage of a lot of what health care reform is right now because they have a lot of the structure in place?
Yes. As far as structure within the Department of Health Services, structure within the California Department of Public Health, they have continued to move forward they have been building all of that framework that you'll need to hang this enrollment of people in the new exchanges and the newly eligible Medi-Cal patients. This is very exciting for us. California is being progressive around this as they often are and had already determined to move forward with this regardless of what happened with the Supreme Court. And by making that determination, it has allowed them to move into a position like no other state in the union. We are prepared as much as anyone can be for 2014. Some of the problems we still face, though, are around capacity. We don't have enough primary care doctors in the system at this point in time to serve this newly insured group of people, and we certainly won't have them by 2014. This is going to put a lot of pressure on already stressed resources. And for the first probably 5 years or so, we're going to see a lot of people who are very frustrated with the health system that they newly have access to because it doesn't quite, you know, rise up to the standards that they think it should in terms of how quickly it should serve them. Still, all in all, it'll be far superior to getting care through the emergency rooms and hospitals and much less expensive than that. And also allow them to get long-term care for, again, these chronic illnesses that have such incredible costs both socially
and really plague
and financially.
The valley.
And really plague the valley.
We have a huge
I mean, look at this
here.
Amputee list that just came out recently. If you think
and the one before that with heart
Exactly. If you doubted we have a diabetes problem before, you should now
rest assured. That was really sad to see that.
Just horrific.
There's a lot of experience about what's going to happen with this program from the Massachusetts experience. As you know, Obamacare is Romneycare. It's the same idea. And in Massachusetts, a couple of things. There has been a real increase in difficulty that people have in getting primary care. There is a shortage of primary care, and the newly insured people have made that difficult. And the federally qualified health centers, the programs comparable to Clinica, have really stepped up to the plate. They've been able to show that they can achieve more efficient care, that they can use their resources, that they can use physician extenders, nurse practitioners, and physicians associates. And so there's lots of excitement both about the potential to do that and to achieve real improvements in health outcomes. So that's perhaps been the most remarkable thing in Massachusetts.
And I think another thing that's remarkable in Massachusetts that shows where we will be, I think we will be, not just can be, is amongst children, they're almost at 100% insured children now. That's a remarkable thought. And adults, greater than 98%.
Wow.
So for all of those who thought this was going to sort of stutter and die, and there were many prognosticators that, you know, a few years ago who said, well, this Massachusetts experiment.
Now, how long they've has only Massachusetts got, had its plan?
Since 2006.
Yeah. Okay. So it's been about five and a half years now.
Right.
Yeah.
So it gives people an idea of really – I guess what you could say, if you kind of want to know what we're in for, maybe is to take a look at Massachusetts and see how long this is going to take. I think what people have to understand, whenever you come up with anything new, especially when you talk about healthcare reform, it's not going to happen overnight. Well, is not going to be perfect overnight.
Just a second ago, I didn't pull the figure about 5 years out of my head, out of the air. I was basing that on what's happened in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It'll be about 5 years before we see the pipeline increase with enough physicians to begin to fill the gaps, not completely, but to begin to fill these gaps, and enough time to have all the systems sort of get linked together to effectively be able to get everybody where they need to go and to move people into this mode of prevention versus I only go to the doctor when my arm hurts.
When I'm sick, yeah. And when it comes to the exchanges, which I think will be exciting for a lot of people, is that California started setting up the exchanges, and they are preparing to start enrolling people next year for the coverage in 2014. What group of people are going to benefit the most from the exchanges?
I think the group that's going to get the most benefit out of the exchange are employees of small businesses. Businesses up to 50 to 80 people will be able to go on the exchange with their employer, either with their employer or on their own, and receive, in many cases, important subsidies. The idea of the Affordable Care Act is that people shouldn't pay more than about 8% of their income toward health insurance. And so there's protections in the act that keep the cost of health insurance down to the individual and also subsidize it for people who have incomes up to 400% of poverty. So that's
400% of poverty, because you mentioned a minute ago about 100%. 400% of poverty, we're talking about people with what kind of an income?
Like $90,000 for a family of four.
Family of four, right.
Yeah.
I think people need to – there's a lot of rhetoric and misinformation about this, that somehow insurance is going to cost people more. There's several good tools out on the internet. I know Kaiser has one on their website, and there's one that's linked to the exchange, the HBX.com website that the state has up that allows you to put in your income right now. And how many people you have in your family, and you can find out exactly what it would cost you to buy insurance under the exchange. And I've had several people try this now. Every one of them have saved at least $50, most $100 a month against their existing employer-based insurance plan. I think the biggest problem with that is employers are a little nervous about this. If you're providing insurance for your employees – And you have – it really relies on all your employees being engaged across all the pay scales within your organization. The people at the lower end of the pay spectrum may find that it's actually more expeditious or better for them, cheaper for them, let's just say, to actually go to the exchange and get insurance. So I think that's something.
Isn't that what people wanted when it came to health care?
Well, that's
personal choice.
They wanted competition and they wanted choice.
This is right. What we think. So what do you think the effect of that? I think the effect of that will be the insurance companies want their business, so they're going to have to drop the cost of those employer-funded insurance programs in order to allow employers to keep purchasing them and keep those employees engaged. I don't think they're just going to walk away from this book of business. I'd be stunned if that happened.
You know, there is a lot of talk when we talk about health care reform. When we talk about health care reform, there's a lot of talk about how this is going to help low-income people. How is this going to help the working poor, and how is this going to help middle-income people, many who are going to work right now with no insurance?
This is the great thing about the exchange and health reform. Suddenly, you've got access to health plans at prices that you can really afford. You mean looking at paying less than $100 a month for full-blown health insurance that covers you and your whole family, not a catastrophic plan that kicks in at $5,000 or $10,000 and has no primary care or preventative aspects to it. But we're talking about full-scope health insurance.
Everybody and, with incomes between $30,000 and $90,000 for a family of four, that's a big swath of people in the Valley, approximately 600,000 people in 2014, will be eligible for subsidized insurance on the exchange.
And those people are – and really that group of people really did need a lot of relief. Now, for our listeners, you know, a lot of people have a lot of questions about healthcare reform. There's a lot of good information. There's a lot of misinformation. And so for our listeners, if you have some questions, please give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. And you can also email us at talk@kbpr.org. We would really like to hear your thoughts on healthcare reform and what you think it might mean to you and your family, or if you just have questions. And getting back to our discussion, we talked about what this would mean for middle-income people. Now, when it comes to setting up the state's program, I understand that the state has already enrolled about 11,000 Californians in its new high-risk insurance pool, and that's something we haven't talked about either. There are a lot of people whose medical histories made it very difficult or impossible for them to get coverage.
Yeah, the high-risk pools made it much more affordable for someone with, for example, a history of diabetes or it had heart disease to purchase insurance. The plans were still very expensive. They were 20% lower than what you might spend on the private market, but they were still very expensive plans. California had a good high-risk pool in place. The federal expansion allowed almost a doubling of the number of people eligible for that plan.
Okay. And that's when you talk about the high-risk plan and a high-risk pool, and we talk about people with existing care, when we look at the health issues we have in the Valley, then you're talking about a huge group of people who already have some kind of existing health concern. Did that contribute in any way to the high number of people who we have or had uninsured in this area because so many people couldn't get insurance?
The majority of these folks work in low-wage jobs that for small employers who can't afford to provide insurance for themselves, let alone their employees. And the Valley is known for that. We're the land of small business. And traditionally, small business owners have not worked with a lot of overhead. And these plans that insurance companies offer are hideously expensive. They can cost as much as $500, $600, even $1,000 an employee. For an employee who's making $10 or $11 an hour, how much can you ask them to contribute to a plan like that? So that's what some of this seeks to address, bringing plans down to the place where someone who's making $12 an hour and has a family of four is going to end up paying $60 a month, say, for a plan. I'm just pulling that out of the air. I'm not looking at the actual grid, but it's pretty close. And at 100, Dr. Kaplan referenced 133, the government's actually giving a 5% credit against income. So it's actually 138% of the federal poverty line who will qualify for the Medicaid benefit. And again, as you move through the federal poverty line, you get to close to $40,000 a year for a family of four who won't have to pay anything, who will have health insurance. Now, this frees them up from worry about bankruptcy, from sudden health bills, from the whole idea of not seeking care because they're afraid of the cost of care, all of the – or not understanding care because they don't have anybody to even talk to about when they should seek care. So it's a huge burden to lift from a small family who's struggling, trying to move forward with their lives.
Now, because California has been proactive and basically really decided that they were going to go move ahead with health care reform, whether the feds did it or not, this state is in line for billions of federal dollars to help implement this.
Right. The estimate is something like $15 billion over the next 10 years, about $6 billion for Medi-Cal expansions and about $9 billion for the subsidies on the exchange.
You know, and the first thing you're going to hear from people is, okay, where does the money come from and how do we kind of pay for all of this? Because the federal government is, when it comes to implementing this, this is a lot of money.
Well, I mean, essentially, this is your tax dollars at work, and people need to think about where they want their tax dollars to be working. There's lots of places. Your taxes are being paid no matter what. So where do you want your tax dollars to end up? It's always a question that I ask myself, where would I want my tax dollars to end up? Well, I'd rather have my tax dollars end up providing health care for people who don't have it than numerous other places I could think of but won't talk about. That's just the reality of our lives here in the United States. We pay taxes every year for the privilege of living in this amazing country and having the amazing freedoms that we have to have conversations like this without worrying about somebody kicking down the door. I think that's what people have to reconcile in their minds. It's not magic money. The government's not printing extra money to do this. It's not going to cause inflation or deflation. It's using the existing funding that's already been earmarked for this project to pay for it.
Right. Now, one of the things when we kind of zero in on Fresno County, and some other counties already did it, many other counties, 47 other counties, went ahead and moved ahead with setting up a low-income health program. And my understanding, community regional medical centers have presented a proposal to do the same here. And Fresno County supervisors decided not to move forward with that because of the cost. So what kind of position does that put us in? There, from what I've read, 47 counties in California, which is nearly all of them then, went ahead and set up a low-income health program and received federal dollars to do that. And Fresno County opted out of that. Does that put us – what kind of position does that put us in when it comes to setting up these programs or moving forward with health care reform?
I don't think that this is a completed story yet. There's a lot of continued discussion between the regional medical center and the county and others about how to move forward and establish a low-income health program. The concerns were understandable in terms of the kinds of risks that different groups were having and who was going to be served and who wasn't going to be served. But there was also an educational problem. We really didn't do a good job of communicating as a medical community why this low-income health program represented an important step for the community and why it was possible to move it forward without creating unnecessary risk. And I think we're making progress on that discussion.
I think people will be happy to hear that.
Yeah. So I'm not in the middle of those discussions, but at least from what I hear, they are
ongoing.
Yeah, that they're ongoing.
They haven't given up. They continue to talk about it. I think it is important just to prod that along a little bit by reminding people that it's an opportunity to get everything set up in your employment and temporary assistance departments that are going to be responsible for enrolling all these people. And part of what LIHP provided, other than the early entry of this population into Medicaid, was the opportunity to sort of tool up, gear up, and get ready for this really onslaught of people who are going to suddenly be eligible January 1st in 2014. And so I think it's an opportunity for the county to prepare itself for what's coming versus getting smacked in the face with it, like I say, in January of 2014, which will create a lot of challenges for the county as an organization. And our county is fragile. We have a lot of difficulties here. Again, we're poor. We have an incredibly poor citizenry. We have
a lot of
diminishing
tax
returns, a lot of chronic health issues. So in this diminishing revenue arena, we've got problems that cost a lot of money to take care of. And it's a huge challenge. So treating LIHP as a resource, I think, is an important thing for people to do. And as John mentions, Dr. Kappetman is stating, group is working on that actively and proactively with folks from the county, and we're hoping to see progress there.
Would the county still be eligible for, I think it was the $50 to $60 million from the federal government to help it implement that?
Yes. Well, you know, it may be prorated a bit, but they would still be eligible. They can step back from that cliff anytime they'd like to. The folks in the state capitol have said, you know, we'd be happy to get your letters rescinding your original denial of the program and work with you to make it successful. So,
you know, and maybe let's just kind of look at that. There are, and maybe the public isn't aware of it, but not just in California, but many people are already benefiting from health care, portions of health care reform.
Sure.
And I think that's what people have to understand. The big portion of this really doesn't go into effect until 2014. That's still 2 years from now.
But there have
been
some important changes
that
people are already experiencing.
Already.
Yeah. I have a number of friends with children who are on their insurance policies.
Yes.
I'm of the age now that has friends who
have kids who are in their 20s.
Kids who are in their 20s.
Right, if your kid is away at college.
Exactly. This is huge. You know, I mean, it's been for my daughter personally, for instance, it's been a great blessing for me and for my family to be able to pay a premium and keep her on the insurance policy. I mean, that's taken a lot of worry from her mother and I, as you can imagine, and for her also. And she's used her health insurance a number of times now in the last
year. Also prescription drugs for older
citizens. Right. There are lots of seniors who have experienced a reduction, $50 a month or more already in their drug costs. In lots of parts of the country, it hasn't quite hit in California. People are receiving rebates from their insurance companies. If insurance companies are spending too much of the insurance dollar on administration and profit, they have to pay back something to their customers. So that's starting to be – those checks are starting to come, and they'll come in California. Important changes for people with pre-existing conditions in terms of children with pre-existing conditions being blocked from changing insurance or getting new insurance. Those are just a few of the things that have happened so far.
Right. With people with children who were paying $100 extra a month for premiums for a child who had asthma, for instance, that's gone away. Asthma is so prevalent in children here, especially in our area. This is a huge, huge boon for folks. It's interesting how that happens, and some people are very casual about that, and they don't seem to connect it quite to the Affordable Care Act. I've talked to folks who've had this happen, and they think, oh, my insurance company stopped charging me for that. And I will remind them that Yes, because the Affordable Care Act said that they couldn't charge you anymore. And suddenly a light bulb goes
for preventive care.
For preventative care. People just don't they don't quite connect the two things together. I think that's a problem with the act in some ways. It's very subtle in some of the ways that it's helping us out right now, and so people don't connect it.
That's why we had both of you in today. There's still a lot of education that needs to be done when it comes to the Affordable Health Care Act and just health care reform and what it all means. So the conversations must continue so that people can get the right information. And so I would like to thank both of you for coming in this morning, Kevin Hamilton with Clinica Sierra Vista and Dr. John Kapitman. Thank you both for the discussion this morning. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, it was 40 years ago this past June that Title IX was signed into law by President Nixon. When we hear Title IX, we automatically think about gender equity in sports. But the legislation is much more than that. The law basically states, and this is what it says, that no person in the U.S. shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Here to discuss all of the benefits of Title IX and how it has impacted girls and women and where we are now is Diane Milutinovich. She's a gender equity expert and former Fresno State Athletics Administrator, and much more than that. But her resume is way too long for me to read, but very accomplished. And, you know, just one of the pioneers when it comes to women in sports, I think, especially here in the Valley. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to see you again as well. Now, you know, it's just when you mention Title IX, I know the first thing that people think about is, well, sports, women in sports. But this really is about much more. And even for myself, last night when I was reading through Title IX and all that it does, you know, it covers so many other areas for women and girls.
Absolutely. And even applies to boys if they're the underrepresented gender. And in a harassment situation like the Penn State situation, it applies to the young men there who were harassed or allegedly harassed by a college coach. So it's far-reaching, and it didn't start with athletics. Athletics was a very small part of Title IX when it was being thought about in the early 1970s.
A lot of it was about education and educational programs.
Correct. It was. It was in admissions to college programs. It's admissions and recruitment. It was in pregnancy policies, allowing students to be on campus. It was in sexual harassment, some employment discrimination, and the rest of career education. So, you know, it was really important for when I went to school, it was in the early mid-60s, girls took homemaking and boys took shop. Today, if boys want to take homemaking and home ec and girls want to do shop, that's perfectly acceptable and really important, so people can do what they're interested in and what will benefit them in their future.
And you know, when you think about that, and it got me to thinking, because my daughter, who played sports from the time she was little all the way through high school and never thought about what she could or couldn't play, she would ask me, "Well, Mom, what did you play?" And when I really thought about it, I'm like, wait a minute, we didn't have competitive sports. I'm probably giving away, you know, my age, but we did not have competitive sports. There was no, you know, soccer team. There was no basketball team. We played amongst each other. And I can remember being one of those in the home ec class, you know. It just, and so you think about that, just how much has changed on that level, because it just wasn't there.
Exactly. When I was in high school in the mid-60s, the women could play two sports. So you could either swim or play tennis, and they were both in the same season, while the boys had football, tennis, swimming, baseball, basketball, and the girls belonged to something called GAA, Girls Athletic Association. So we went off to play days, and we thought that was okay, you know. We were disappointed we didn't get to play, but we didn't really know that that was a problem.
Right. No, we didn't. And I think when you talk about the progress, here are some of the stats that I have, that from 1972 to 2011, the number of girls and women participating in high school sports grew from 294,000 to 3 million. And in colleges, it went from about 15% up to 43%. So once the door was open, you had a lot of young women and girls playing. And now today, I just don't think any of them think there's anything they can't do when it comes to athletic and sports.
Exactly. And that's the important part. When girls and women have been given the opportunity, they've certainly filled every slot there is for participation and continue to be very interested in continuing sports, because mothers and fathers learned that the same benefits that their sons were getting from participating in sports, their daughters would also benefit from: leadership skills, stick-to-itiveness, better staying in education longer, and those kinds of things. So it's been a big benefit to both boys and girls and men and women as students, and helps them continue their education and be healthier and better prepared for life as they age and go through their professional lives.
Okay, let's break it down in some of these areas when we talk about what Title IX does cover. Let's look at admissions and recruitment. What is the benefit there?
Well, in the old days, the women usually had a floor or a ceiling on how many women could be allowed into school if they were allowed into a certain programs, whether it was law school or medical school. Today, both of those professions are wide open to women. One of the professions that's lagging in women participation is in engineering, and we just need to provide more opportunities for girls and women to continue their math and science, which is a big push by the government these days in most every school district, to have girls continue their math and science as they go through junior high, high school, and on to college.
You know, I was reading some of the information, and it was Dr. Mae Jamison, the first African-American astronaut, and she credits Title IX for women being in the sports, space program.
Right. I saw her hearing last week prior to I think it was June 21st, before Congress, and she was very supportive of Title IX in education, and how that helped her get through her degree in engineering and move on toward the space program. And now she belongs to a nonprofit that she heads a nonprofit that supports girls and women and minorities in the STEM program. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math.
And we talked about Title IX, but when one of the areas covered is career education. And, you know, think back to when they had vocational education programs in our high schools. I mean, where were the girls and where were the boys when it came to vocational education or tech prep programs? You know, there was a difference there.
Right, and it was limiting. It was limiting for both girls and boys. You know, it's interesting today. If you go into a hospital or into a doctor's office, you see a lot more male nurses than you ever saw before. And in women, you see a lot more women in the being chefs in a kitchen of a restaurant that usually was male-dominated. And today there are more women who are chefs. And so there's a whole number of things that women mechanics, women at PG&E climbing up the poles and all those kinds of things.
Right. Another category, employment discrimination. And before we move on, I do want to introduce another guest that we have joining us is Elizabeth Christian. She's a senior staff attorney for Legal Aid Society and probably has worked a lot when it comes to trying to implement Title IX. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So in the area of employment discrimination and sexual harassment, how did Title IX help there?
Well, I think that Diane's already touched on some of the ways in which Title IX has really opened the doors for women. It also opened the doors with respect to employment in academic institutions. And so certainly before Title IX, women were not entering the academic fields of being professors and instructors, and any kind of job opportunities were really foreclosed to them. And so that has certainly dramatically changed as well. And certainly the sexual harassment law under Title IX has helped address not only sexual harassment of adults, but has begun to address sexual harassment of children in schools and is in some instances being used to address bullying as well.
But even when we look at Title IX and we're looking at it because it's the 40th anniversary, so 40 years ago, but even today, not all institutions are in compliance.
That's certainly true, and one of the areas that my office works in a lot has to do with high school athletics, and we represent girls in high school who are being discriminated against, and we found that even 40 years after Title IX, there's some blatant lack of compliance. And if you look at the data from our statewide interscholastic federation, what it shows is that only about 40% of athletic participants in California are girls. And that is shocking because we know, and I know Diane has talked about this, you know, we know that girls are interested in participating in sports in greater numbers. And basically, schools are not in compliance. If their enrollment is about 50% female, which most high schools are, then their athletic opportunities should be provided in those proportions. And so we find that not only are most high schools not complying with Title IX on participation, they're also providing unequal facilities for girls. And in one of the cases we litigated in San Diego, we won in a trial about the school not providing equal facilities for girls at that school. That was a class action lawsuit that just was resolved this year. So again, 40 years after Title IX, we're still finding what I think is blatant noncompliance.
And Diane?
And there's also a problem with the financing of the programs. Because the financing from the school district or whatever is dried up, they've reverted to using Booster Club funds. And everybody thinks that if you have Booster Club funds, then the school is not responsible for providing equitable opportunities, equipment, facilities, shoes, gloves, balls, bats, whatever it takes. And so that becomes a problem. And one additional problem, it kind of ties into the employment realm, is for most of the sports, the boys usually have a PE teacher, someone on campus, and for girls sports, they usually bring somebody in from off campus. That means the girls have less access to their coach, and whether it's a male or female, and they have less time to spend with that coach than the boys do. So that presents another problem.
And I won't give my opinion, but just to say that I have two children, a boy and a girl. And the boy plays baseball, and the girl played volleyball and other sports. And a huge difference in what was made available to the boys.
Right. And that's,
and including the coaches and the teachers and everybody else.
Yes. And you know, it's kind of distressing. Donna Lopiano, who used to be at the Women's Sports Foundation, used to talk about a family who had three children. The first one was a son, and he was a football player, and the daughter was a tennis player, and they were able to take care of all of them. Then the third child came along, and he wanted to wrestle. They didn't kill him off. They divided the resources equitably. So I think that's how school districts need to look at their how they support their programs and make sure they're providing equitable.
I think that also points up the importance of parents. And what we hear a lot is that it's parents and often fathers who are the ones who are the best advocates for their kids with respect to Title IX, because many of these dads were athletes and they saw how well they were treated as male athletes. And I think some of them didn't even know that they were being treated differently than the girls. And they don't realize that until they have a daughter. And they're taking their daughter to her softball games, and they say, wait a second, I went to this school, I played on this baseball field, the baseball field's really nice, what's going on with this softball field? And so that's often how we're contacted, is from fathers and parents who are really shocked and outraged by the terrible conditions that their kids are facing in the schools.
What are some of the reasons the institutions give for still failing to comply with Title IX?
Most of the time, they are raising budgetary concerns. And certainly, we know that our schools are strapped for money. And so, you know, I'm not trying to minimize the idea that there could be serious budgetary concerns. But as Diane mentioned, you know, we need to share our resources fairly and equitably. And Title IX has been around for 40 years. So there have been some good times and there have been some bad times in the past 40 years. But we've been hearing this budgetary excuse every year. And so that, I think, is, while budgets are a real concern, I don't think this inequitable distribution of the funds that do exist is a fair excuse. And then, believe it or not, we're still hearing sometimes that girls aren't interested in playing sports, or they're not interested in playing sports in greater numbers. And everything that we know about sports shows that girls want to participate in greater numbers. And if you provide them with a quality program, with coaches that care about them, with active recruitment, girls want to be out there playing in greater numbers.
And I think, following up, we accept a difference in athletics that we wouldn't accept in a science class. We wouldn't allow a booster to come in and give brand new microscopes to the female students and tell the boys they have to use the old microscopes. I mean, it's just not acceptable in an educational realm. So athletics on an educational realm is the same thing, so we shouldn't accept that same inequity.
You know,
I think that's right, Diane. This excuse of private money is used quite often. And as Diane correctly stated, it's not an excuse for providing unequal facilities and opportunities for girls.
You know, Diane, if you could, I'd just like for you, because you, number one, you've been in this battle for a long time. And not only that, you know, you had your own situation with having a lawsuit settled. But do you think, when you look back on it, you know, when it comes to women in sports and women in higher education, for yourself, what have you seen change over all those years? And what would you like to see happen?
Well, I think we've seen tremendous changes that we had to come from so far. Just your numbers that you gave us earlier showed that, you know, we've gone from, like, I think you said 13% to 43%. That's tremendous growth. But it's nowhere near the 57% of college students where we could provide opportunities. Elizabeth pointed out that there's never been a sport that's been added to a school that they couldn't fill if they had a good coach. And so and you can recruit to that. I think we need to see that. Once we get the participation realm taken care of, we have the scholarship issues to make them equitable, especially with cost of education going up. Women need that money just as much as the men do. And then there's what's called the laundry list. There's 11 other areas in athletics, from coaching to tutoring to equipment to facilities to academic support to other support. There's a whole list of things. And those areas need to be addressed in providing girls the equal opportunity. How many times do you drive by a high school billboard and see the boys' schedule announced, and you don't see the girls' schedule? How many posters do you see for the football team but see nothing for the softball team or the volleyball team? You know, all those things count. And even if they just divided the money in half and gave half to the women, you know, and then they always say, well, people aren't interested in coming to games. I beg your pardon. I just watched the Women's College World Series on television. The place was sold out at 8,000-plus people and had great TV ratings. So, you know, if ESPN is covering the Softball World Series every single game, then they must be getting some viewership. So I say, if you build it, they will come. So if they build women's sports programs, people will come.
And I think one of the things you said really has made a difference. It's these dads and fathers whose daughters are now playing sports, and they take a look and see, you know, some of the inequities, and so they're willing to move forward and to speak up. So the more and more young women do participate, you know, their parents can see it and say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here.
Elizabeth made the perfect point there, because parents, no parent likes to see one child treated better than the other. And if it's good for one, it should be good for the other, both sexes. And so I think that's extremely important, and that's where people need to make sure they educate themselves and they speak up. There is no downside to speaking up. So inequities will continue if people don't speak up.
Well, a great discussion. I'd like to thank both of you, Diane Milutinovic, a gender equity expert and former Fresno State Athletics Administrator, and Elizabeth Christian, Senior Staff Attorney, Legal Aid Society.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Welcome back. We are going to talk about Big Brothers, Big Sisters. With us is Richard Lohr, the executive director, and Nancy Conway, the fund development officer for this great organization here in the Central Valley. And there is, Mr. Lohr, always a need for more mentors.
We have 150 children on our waiting list right now who are desperately seeking someone in their life who can be there for them, that one special person. And so we're constantly looking for people who would like to take a child into their life, who can be there for them and be that one special person. And we're not asking for people to entertain a child. What we're really asking them for is to take a child into their life and do with a child what you normally do with your own children. It can be simple things, going grocery shopping, walking the dog, baking cookies, planting a garden.
It's really just having somebody there who cares about the child and is invested in their well-being.
That's exactly what it is. Somebody who can listen, can guide, direct, who can be a friend, who can serve as a role model, who can show children that there is a different way of life, who can be there to build self-confidence, help with their ego, help with their school.
And we know that makes a difference in a young person's life.
Absolutely. You know, the most important thing I think that people need to know is that not only does it make a difference for the children, but it also makes a difference for the volunteer. So you really get a lot out of this experience as the adult mentor as well. It's a good thing on both sides.
But, you know, I think it's good for the entire community. When you talk about when you have children who don't have that other significant adult in their life, mm-hmm. We know that sometimes it can take them down the wrong road. So we all benefit if someone is there engaging these young people and showing that they care about them.
Exactly. And, you know, the really powerful statistics that we have shown over the past few years is children in our program locally. To me, the most important part is that they, number one, think that they will now be successful where before they didn't. And they believe in themselves and feel better about themselves. And they believe that not only will they graduate high school, which they didn't believe before, they believe that they will go on to do bigger and better things with their education. So for us, that's very, very powerful for our program. You know, and one of the things I think that's really important is that these kids really, they need an opportunity to be able to dream. They don't know about dreaming. They don't know about possibilities. And so that's part of, you know, the simple things that Richard was talking about that can make such a huge difference is just to share possibilities with these kids.
What do you need from someone who chooses to be a big brother or big sister? What kind of commitment do you need?
We ask that a volunteer stay with us for a minimum of 1 year. And to help ensure that the match is successful, we do a very, very careful screening and a very careful matching of a child to a mentor so that both the child's parent, and the potential big feel good about this match so that it can go forward. We ask a minimum of 1 year and 3 to 4 hours per week. We actually find that many of our matches go on far beyond this. Our average is actually about 2 years. And for many, this becomes a lifetime match. Nancy and I recently had the opportunity to meet a gentleman who is now in his early 40s. He approached us after we did a presentation, said he was very excited to hear about it because he'd been matched in our program from the time he was 8 until he was 18. And he still is in contact with that big. The roles have changed. The big is now in a position where he needs some assistance due to health problems. Mm-hmm. And his little is there for him. It's a lifetime relationship. This man is a school teacher, and he said he picked going into education because he wanted to be able to pay it forward. He wanted to pay it back for others. And he said had it not been for his big, he knows that he would have taken a much different path in life.
Why do we have such a need here in our region, Fresno County? Because we have, as you mentioned, a lot of kids waiting right now.
Well, this is not just a Fresno. It's not a Central Valley issue. Unfortunately, this is a nationwide issue. I can't say that we are that different than many other parts of the country. We have a particular need for males. Males from all backgrounds to serve. And we're not looking just for young people. Actually, we look at the statistics for our bigs, and we find that most of them are mid-30s up through mid-60s, not 20-something. So we're looking for people who have some life experience, some stability, some time, who want to give back. If you're retired, this is an
opportunity
for you. We have no age limit on being a big. So anybody from 18 to infinity.
Wow, that's great.
And, you know, it's really true. One of the things that I think that the awareness is critical for us, and that's really why we're so thankful to come and speak out here with you today, Juanita. One of the things I think is that people, it's not so much that they don't want to help, that they don't know how they could help or what an impact their help could be. And so reaching out to those people is huge for us, you know. And as I shared with you earlier, I am in the program now to also become a big, and I'm going to be matched with my little later this week. And I'm really excited about it. And for me, I'm at a different time in my life. Obviously, our children are grown. And so certainly I'm involved with work and everything, but I have a few hours a week that I can share with the child. And the other thing is that a lot of people, I think it's just too much for them to take on. They think we
when you say a year and three hours a week,
that's just overwhelming.
But when you really think about it,
well, the thing of it is that it is overwhelming when you think about it, because who says that they have an extra hour, let alone an extra 3 hours? No one does. The realization of it is that once you start this, even if you committed to yourself for 1 hour, you'll easily do the 3 hours, because the time passes, the relationship builds, and the feeling builds, and you'll be excited about being in the program. And that's what we've really found, is that it's so much easier and people are so much more willing to give of themselves and their time once they get going in the program.
And they don't have to do this by themselves. These are professionally supported matches. So we have casework staff, match support specialists who are there to assist and advise and train and mentor.
So they do get some support and
Absolutely.
Some training.
Oh, most
Absolutely.
Definitely. And that's one of the reasons why this is a very successful program, is because you're not thrown out simply on your own. You do have support.
What do people need to do if they want to, as you call them, think about becoming a big?
Well, there's a couple of ways. You can go to our website, which is bigs.org, B-I-G-S.org, or you can call us at the office. Okay. 268-2447 is the number.
And that's any time.
Absolutely. We'd love to hear
now,
from anyone.
For the people who want to participate, what about them? I'm sure, you know, there's screenings and all that other
mm-hmm.
stuff
Correct.
That you do.
Right. There's a process. We start some initial paperwork, and then we go through the process. It takes about 30 days from start to finish to get everything done in our agency right
okay.
now.
Okay.
The other thing I want to emphasize, the interesting thing is that the territory that we cover is almost identical to your listenership, because we serve Bakersfield through Madera.
Wow.
So whether you're in Bakersfield,
Visalia,
Tulare, Fresno, Clovis, Madera, we're the organization that provides the mentors in that area.
Okay. Richard Lord, the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters, and Nancy Conway, fund development officer. You heard it. They would love to have more of you participate. And we here at KVPR 89 like to thank all of you for joining us today and sharing your time with us. We'll be back next Tuesday. Until then, you have a great day.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.